This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high.
Hey, good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Just about 9 o'clock on this Thursday morning, June 6th. Coming up in a half hour on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogarang discusses a recent article by author and journalist Dr. Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed and it's called UK Pays Price for MI5 Courting Terror. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 today, Flashpoints presents an update on the military whistleblower trial of Bradley Manning with civil rights attorney Bill Simplich. Actually, Simplich is his name. Courtroom artists Kay Rudin and journalist Norman Solomon. We also get an update on sectarian violence, which continues to grow in Iraq, with more than 1,000 people killed in May. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Sarika Mehta interviews Filipina writer Marivi Sullivan about her new novel, The Mango Bride. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, host Emma Jackson Ford, Patricia Welch, and O.B. Hill interview legendary author Maya Angelou about Mom and Me and Mom, her book about her relationship with her mother. That's all coming up, but first, in just a few seconds, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell, and that's coming up on KBOO.
Native Americans account for less than 2% of Oregon's population, yet we make up greater than 4% of its prison population. I'm Trish Jordan of Red Lodge Transition Services. We began our work in Oregon prisons advocating for religious freedom and human rights. Join me on Prison Pipeline June 10th to hear how Red Lodge helps Native American women rebuild their lives after incarceration, often helping them reconnect to Native spirituality and culture. That's Prison Pipeline June 10th at 6:30 p.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Also, thanks to a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for the news you're not supposed to know. I want to talk about the economy today. I want to talk about revolution, but there are headlines that need to be addressed. Syrian missiles have hit Israeli territory. According to an article that popped up on NBC News this morning, two missiles from Syria landed in Israel. Today, as fighting between President Bashar Assad's forces and rebels raged on the Golan Heights, the Israel Defense Forces said that a closed military zone was declared near the border crossing in response to the fighting. People are not being allowed inside the area, and locals were being warned not to work in the fields. No one was injured on the Israeli side, but two wounded Syrians came to the border, were taken to hospitals in Israel, according to an IDF spokeswoman. She said there were two projectiles that landed earlier in open areas in the north and central Golan Heights near the border of Israel and Syria. Syrian TV reports the government forces backed by Hezbollah fighters, have taken the strategic town of Qusair that has been in opposition control since 2011. And there's more on that at NBC News, which is not something that I normally like to mention, but this is breaking news. So I imagine that there are other news sources on it by now, since a couple hours ago that I picked that up. From RIA Novosti, Syria has the right to strike Israel in the case of any possible Israeli attacks in the future. That's according to Al Arabiya reporting on Thursday, citing Ahmad Salash, a member of the Syrian parliament. They quoted Salash saying, "Next time if Israel dares to breach the Syrian airspace, next time there are orders to retaliate with fire and missiles without referring back to the leadership, Israel is," and that was the end of the quote, "Israel is widely believed to have carried out several airstrikes on Syria in early May, though it has not officially confirmed that it did so." Reuters reported, citing unnamed Western intelligence sources, that the airstrikes targeted a shipment of Iranian-made Fateh 110 guided missiles believed to be on their way to Lebanon's Hezbollah militant group. According to Syria's state news agency Sana, the Israel attack targeted a research facility near the capital Damascus. The quote from Salash continued, "Let it all out. They want an open war. Let it be an open war. We don't have a problem," end quote. Heck of a way to use the Americanism, I suppose. Seems like a war would be a problem. The pro-militarist Israeli site Debka reports a large American military force disembarked Tuesday, June 4th, at the southern Jordanian port of Aqaba, ready for deployment on the kingdom's Syrian border. And they say the force made its way north along a mountain road bisecting Jordan from south to north under heavy Jordanian military escort. And they say that this is 1,000 troops from the members of the 24th Marine Expeditionary Force carried aboard the USS Kearsarge, which has been in the region, part of the 5th Fleet. If you want to find more information on this, pull up a search engine and put in a news search engine and put in U.S. 5th Fleet or just 5th Fleet, and you'll find more information. Kearsarge has been anchored off Israeli Eilat since mid-May. Upon landing, the Marines took to the road in a convoy of armored vehicles, including Humvees. Washington and Amman, write Debka, have imposed a blackout on their arrival. The Pentagon has only let it be known that the annual joint U.S.-Jordanian Eager Lion 2013 military exercise is due to begin later in June and last 2 months with F-16s and Patriot missiles. And they say that the arrival of the U.S. force in Jordan was not directly related to the regular exercise, but decided on at an emergency meeting of the Pentagon on May 31st, which was attended by top military and civilian Defense Department officials. The meeting decided that the military situation evolving in Syria and the threats it poses to Jordan, including widening evidence of chemical weapons use in Syria, were urgent enough to warrant the dispatch of extra military American military strength to Jordan over and above the contingents participating in the joint exercise. And they say the Israeli Air Force will provide air cover. Now, departing from that, the chemical warfare claim is, of course, the derivation of the old weapons of mass destruction ruse. And if you look at it really closely, you can see that there's really not much evidence of any substantial one-sided use of chemical weaponry. In other words, the Syrian government is not using chemical weapons, bombs, as far as I can tell. So the war situation is blowing up in Syria and in the region there. And of course, there are U.S. and Israeli weapons all over the place. If you want to talk about that, the number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO. The talk these days is which services to cut. And that's very convenient for the super rich who caused the re-depression with their gambling and their bailout by their bought and paid for government. As long as we're fighting with each other over which services to cut, we aren't fighting with billionaires and their corporations over the trillions that they hide in offshore tax evasion accounts. This is true from the local to the national to the international level. Here in Portland, we raise taxes on everyone but the out-of-town rich landowners who own most of the downtown property. I found out about Portland's $240 million in reserves by reading an article on a national website, Counterpunch. It's not something that I've found mentioned much locally. You know, I do want to praise the local news. I want to praise the Oregonian for covering the Precision Cast Parts strike. At least that's actually happening. Not that they cover it all that well, I suppose, but it's covered. So, and there is, you know, there is union news right there on the front page of the Oregonian newspaper. Who would have thought? But glad to see that. But returning to the topic, you might think that it would only be reasonable for the city council's assets to be visible to its own citizens. You might think it outrageous that the Oregon legislature, which spends nearly every working hour trying to cut needed services to Oregonians these days, would have a special session just to assure the Nike billionaires that they would not be taxed. You might think Apple and Microsoft and Google might get busted for dodging taxes internationally, but billionaires don't want the rest of us thinking on those terms. In terms of a just and equitable society. Just and equitable societies are just pure hell on those who would accumulate wealth on the backs of the working class and the you aren't even allowed to be working class. The class that Marx once labeled lumpen proletariat and which now encompasses a gigantic slice of our once proud society. Oh, hell no. The wealth game works much better when, as Jim Hightower says, it's a case of let's you and him fight. And the fight is killing us. Isn't that convenient? We are much more familiar, by and large, with the term sequester than with the fact that the super rich are allowed to stash their wealth in hidey holes from the Lesser Antilles to Geneva. So here's an excerpt, actually an introduction to an interview with Sanjay Basu, also from Counterpunch, counterpunch.org. It's by Laura S. Flanders, and she writes, "It stands to reason that people suffer stress when money's short. But do economically hard times in and of themselves kill people?" Sanjay Basu, co-author of a book called The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, argues that it's not the economy, it's the austerity that's deadly. As he puts it in his interview, "Health doesn't start on my exam room table or in the intensive care unit. It starts at home with the food that we eat, whether we smoke or drink too much, the safety of our neighborhoods. These are the major determinants of our health," end quote. Everything else being equal, it turns out that zip code is the leading determinant of our health and life expectancy. That's what Basu says, and that's why austerity, cutting services and shrinking care, isn't just bad for our economy because it swells layoffs and shrinks spending. It's also dangerous to human health. Doesn't it seem a tad unseemly to have to make the case in body counts before people will care? Well, yes, it does, says Basu, quoting, "It is somewhat perverse to have to make that point. The economists and my colleagues certainly have already shown the economic point that the austerity rationale has already fallen apart. But to really understand what the human costs are, you have to look at the most vulnerable, and unfortunately, they tend to be ignored within the scheme of discussion," end quote. The American Journal of Public Health now estimates that Americans stand a greater chance of dying from the effects of austerity than being killed in a car crash. According to Basu, homeless Americans have the same life expectancy as people in war-torn Sierra Leone or Congo. Do policy alternatives exist that are proven to protect public health while also speeding recovery? Yes, reports Basu, citing examples from countries as diverse as Malaysia, Iceland, and Sweden. More on Iceland in a minute. What's standing in the way of smarter choices? Ideology, he suggests, and also, yes, racism. Perhaps, he concludes, we should have cared more about the Soviets. There was a dramatic spike in deaths after the Harvard set, Jeffrey Sachs, you know, of Goldman Sachs, Larry Summers et al., imposed austerity there. History is repeating now as the same austerity triggered excess deaths mount in the U.S. and beyond. We see the same response in desperate attempts to cover the data, says Sanjay Basu. And that's an associate professor of medicine epidemiology at the University of Stanford, interviewed in Counterpunch by Laura Flanders. I recommend the article, counterpunch.org. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Elliot's on the line.
Well, I'm on?
Yeah.
I am an even-handed progressive, and as an even-handed progressive, I see no reason why United States naval and air power shouldn't stop the genocide by the Syrian minority government and then compel the Jordanians and the Turks and the other regional powers to occupy the place in order to restore some order and arrange for elections. And in the process, since the Iranians are the ultimate plutocratic dictators, there's no reason why we shouldn't do something to stop Iran from promoting terrorism by Hezbollah.
And that's even-handed, you say.
It's not a humanitarian organization.
Even-handedness, you say. No, Hezbollah is a pretty nasty organization.
And the Iranians are oppressing both financially and politically or human rights-wise. They've been oppressing their population since long before the Green Revolution.
Yeah, you know, the problem with the Iranian oppressors is they just really didn't have it down, and so we had to give them lessons. So back in the 50s, we installed the Shah and the Savak secret police to torture Iranians and show them, just give them a leg up, basically.
We should drop leaflets with the code word Mossadegh on the Iranian population, saying that, you know, there are
we're their
forces
buddies.
Yeah,
read this leaflet. We're your buddies now.
They don't like the overthrow of Mossadegh. And a lot of Iranians, because a lot of rank-and-file urban Iranians like the United States, and they would probably rise and overthrow the Ayatollahs if they saw pushback by the West, analogous to what had to be done in Libya when
another
dictator was slaughtering the internal population.
It's funny how useful those dictators have been to the United States. For example, when we needed someone tortured, well, we could just ship them over to Syria, and it seems like we're ungrateful for their useful services now.
Useful to the plutocratic American elite, not necessarily useful to the American citizen and or taxpayer.
Well, okay, I think that's where we agree. But that kind of raises the question: is who are we? When you say we do this, it's like we ain't doing nothing. It's like the United States imperial government is going to decide what's going to come down in Syria, and whether you are opposed to it or not is not going to have anything to do with it.
Well, I wouldn't mind if there was some international force that did something about the Chinese plutocrats enslaving their own population, quite analogous to the Iranian plutocrats enslaving their population, and finally the American plutocrats, basically, if not enslaving, then in the process of designing the enslavement of its own population. There's an increasing symmetry around the world, which Richard Wolff, on his economic analysis, within the undemocratic context of Pacifica, is talking about.
All right. Well, thank you for your opinion. I try to look at it. I suppose everyone tries to be even-handed. When I look at the situation there, I have to remind myself of American history in the region and of what the U.S. has done and continues to do to the Iranian population. They are surrounded by U.S. forces. They are under embargo. They're having trouble getting medicines at this point. I could go on. But I would say that when it comes to actually restoring order, probably the last people you want to invite in are the Americans. Case in point, Afghanistan. Last place in the world you would want to be right now. Well, pretty close to the last. If it's not the last, it's way down there on the bottom. And that's an American occupation, if you like. So I think the situation in Syria is terrible. And I think that both sides are horrible. And I think that the best way to really make things worse is to go invade. Talking about the economy here, in this context of bankster predation, I look at the stock market reports from New York yesterday with interest. Went down a little bit yesterday. Seems to be bouncing just, well, I wouldn't say bouncing, just a little bit up, down in Europe. Not that I don't fear, as we all must, that things are about to get rapidly worse. I'm looking to see if the stumble will continue into a crash, as it inevitably must. It is inevitable because the wholly owned Congress has allowed the derivatives market to continue, has allowed the gambling on gambling to continue, and that gambling on gambling has a price tag that literally cannot be paid. Talking about those derivatives markets, talking about the quadrillions. That's not possible. So it's just a matter of time before a major collapse. And the question is that time now? It's too early in the day yet to tell. But I don't want to take a passive wait-and-see approach. I want the bastards off our backs now. Consider this article by Carl Gibson on Alternate titled, Five Ways the U.S. Can Have an Icelandic Revolution. He writes, we have to nationalize the banks. We have to get rid of the government. We need to have access to the internet seen as a human right. We need to have a new constitution. That's quoting Birgitta Jonsdottir, founder of the Icelandic Pirate Party. Jonsdottir, a lifelong political activist and recently re-elected member of the Icelandic Parliament, was describing the four central demands of the new political revolution sweeping Iceland since the financial collapse. We can create power and be the government and be the media. If Iceland can do it, you can do it, she said. I just love that. I'm just going to say that again. We have to nationalize the banks. We have to get rid of the government. We need to have access to the internet seen as a human right. We need to have a new constitution. Oh, yeah, that felt good. And she also said, as I just said, we can create power. We can create power and be the government and be the media. By the way, this is your media. This is not government-supported, not corporate-supported, you-supported KBOO Portland. We are coming up on an election here at KBOO Portland that's going to determine a lot of things. And one thing I've noticed is that this has been a great big struggle. Political struggle at KBOO, which is probably good for us. You know, we need to think about what we're doing. And one thing I've noticed is that faction is inviting people to join KBOO at the cheapest possible level in order to be able to vote in the next election. See, that's how important the board elections are here at KBOO. Well, two can play that game. If you would like to join KBOO, why don't you do it now? And if you've been holding off because you think it might cost a bit too much, well, you only need $20. So pull up kboo.fm and click that tip jar, and you'll get the paperwork in the mail, and you'll be able to vote in the next election, which is coming up pretty soon now. If you want to, by the way, if you want to be on the KBOO board, you don't have to jump through all the hoops that you find on the website. Actually, the bylaws state that you merely need to get in your statement by the deadline, which is coming up later this month. So if you get in your statement, and if you're a KBOO member, you can run for the board and do that in the next couple of weeks. Go right ahead if you want. Now, I was talking about what Iceland has done and what we could do. The struggle in Iceland is ongoing, but the nation's people have achieved monumental results in a relatively short amount of time due to the nature of their movement building. They managed to arrest and jail the bankers who wrecked the economy. When the government privatized public banking institutions to their friends, essentially for free, and made people pay for the bailouts, the people threw them out of office and refused to give the banks their money. And since Iceland only recently achieved independence from Denmark in 1944, their boilerplate constitution had never been updated. The movement in Iceland successfully used direct democracy to crowdsource a new constitution via Facebook and Twitter. And that crowdsourced constitution was widely supported by the people as the official model for a new constitution. While Iceland's politicians have since ignored the will of the people, a budding new political force in Iceland is building a movement in parliament to change that. We can learn from Iceland and accomplish similar goals here. That's from the article by Carl Gibson on Alternate. I do want to pass on more of that. Your comments at 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. And Thomas is on the air.
Yes, Teresa. Hey, in relation to this question of austerity, I rather like the idea of austerity. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah? How come? How austere are you?
I think it's I think it really should be austerity time for the Wall Street bankster parasitic drones. I think it's time that they receive a walking paper so that they can be free to go out and find honest jobs that actually contribute something useful to society, maybe janitors, you know, plumbers, nurses, what have you. I think austerity would be great. It just needs to be directed in the right direction. And another thought, you know, is interesting, listening to your previous caller who went out of the way to define himself as a progressive and then went forward to read a litany of ideas about how the United States and the so-called international community or what have you should militaristically intervene.
Even-handed, well, I believe.
I guess I must reside in a parallel universe because I must be a different type of progressive because I seem to remember things. I remember the death squad Democrats of the 1980s that were all quick to sign off on the genocidal regimes in El Salvador and the Contras killing people in Nicaragua. And, of course, we all know about what's gone on in Guatemala because of the recent press with the genocide trials down there. You know, and I also remember just a few years ago when all the mainstream liberal media, you know, New York Times, and I also remember Atlantic Monthly talking about weapons of mass destruction. And I just have to wonder if your, you know, previous caller and other progressives and, let's say, Democrats or centrists, I wonder if they're so quick to advocate for the establishment of UN troops and peacekeepers in places like Bahrain, which is systematically repressing its population, or how about Saudi Arabia? Instead of going to Afghanistan to support so-called women's rights, why don't we go to places like Saudi Arabia, which Amnesty International talks about as being one of the most long-time repressors of women's rights and holders of political prisoners? Or for that matter, could we advocate going into Israel? And since we're having essentially a Kristallnacht every day in and day out, as Palestinian homes and shops are being brutally taken away by it, so I really wonder if we want to sort of promulgate this sort of bizarre, jilted Wilsonian idea of being the world's police, are we willing to apply it to uniformly or just to whoever the boogeyman du jour, like Iraq or Iran? That's my big question to these progressives. Are we willing to apply it across the board or just to the boogeyman du jour?
Imperialism, I think, is the name of it. Well, thank you very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Even though American and Icelandic cultures are different, the populism recently galvanized by Occupy can achieve the same goals that Iceland achieved if we organize around similar unifying principles. We have to first unite around class lines rather than fake ideological constructs. When we come across divisive issues like guns and abortion, we have to acknowledge that while we may have different opinions, we should instead find ways to agree on more unifying issues. Example, strive for unity and solidarity when coming across different ideological leanings. If they say the government spends too much money, agree with them, then add that the U.S. spends way too much on maintaining an imperial military presence and on an intrusive police and surveillance complex that we call Jim Crow that only serves to violate our civil rights. If they bring up a divisive issue, tell them while you may have disagreeing opinions on that one issue, the other root causes of our problems should be addressed first and foremost. Remind them that it only serves those abusing their positions of power when people are fighting one another instead of questioning their elected officials. That's from an article by Carl Gibson on Alternate titled Five Ways the U.S. Can Have an Icelandic Revolution. Well, look at that. I burned up the time and didn't have time for the last caller. Sorry about that. If you will stay tuned to KBOO Portland, you will find more delightful things. And while you're tuning in, you know, you can use an antique radio receiver. And when you're listening to KBOO on your antique radio receiver, why, no one can track it. Think about that. And all the ships at sea.
One step forward, two steps backwards.
Tune in to Shocks of Shiva this Thursday, June 6th at noon as we share an exclusive interview with reggae legend Max Romeo. Again, that's this Thursday, June 6th, Shocks of Shiva with Max Romeo, a KABU exclusive.
Well, good morning, and welcome to Fight the Empire. This is episode 100 of Fight the Empire. My first show was back in, about 4 years ago, and my guest then was Pepe Escobar, and we talked about Balochistan, which is a region in Pakistan, which is right on the Iranian border, and it was, you could consider Balochistan a piece in the new great game because the U.S. Was using it as a kind of a base for terror attacks in Iran. And, well, Pepe Escobar is still writing about what he calls Pipelinistan. That was a term that he coined, Pipelinistan, that oil lines and gas lines are very, very important. They are sort of the basis of a lot of these wars that are going on. And Iran is still the key.